everyone, and welcome to the first Projector Room podcast for 7 years without Alan Gilday. What a shame. What a very sad moment that we should be just the two of us, Gareth and me. What do you think of that loss, Gareth?
Who?
What was his name again?
Aidan. No, Aidan does whatever works.
Yeah, we got a bit of feedback from the people in the group. Mike Latour says, best wishes for the future, Alan. You'll be greatly missed. Irf and Ali, I would definitely miss Alan practicing his various accents. All the best for the future. Phil Harding says, I will miss Alan, but also looking forward to the horror-themed treats of 2026. Eyes Without a Face is a great place to start. Haven't seen it for years, but it's a classic. Influenced loads of films, including The Skin I Live In. There's a sequence showing the failed experiments, which always stuck in my mind. And Chad Dixon says, I will really miss Alan, as he was a great third point of view on some titles, especially some of the sci-fi stuff, which you guys have reviewed over the years. Good luck to Alan in the future. So thank you for that bit of feedback from the guys that do the four people that listen to our podcast.
Well, yes, Alan did say that he would likely be popping back in every now and again for a wee cup of tea, just to keep in touch, possibly around the time one of his movies has been released, so he can review it and tell us how great he is in it, give us factoids and trivia about it as well.
Yes, indeed. We'll look forward to that. GarethMiles.com is where you'll find Gareth. TedSalmon.com is where you'll find me. ProjectorRoom.co.uk is our website. Links to all the stuff we're going to talk about today in there. And we start off with a new section. We thought, Gareth's idea this was, that we would have a news section, like we kind of do on Tech Addicts, I suppose, and see what stories we've got coming out from the industry, and we thought that might generate some interest. Would you like to explain your rationale?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of movie news, and I know movie news isn't the same as what it used to be back whenever you like bought Film Review or Premiere or Empire, and they would talk about the new Harrison Ford film and the new Clint Eastwood film, and there'd be trackers and things of all the big movie stars, because, you know, movies are changing so considerably. I was actually thinking just the other day, you know, that there used to be a distinguishing level between TV stars and movie stars. You know, you had your the TV stars that would try to transition into movie stars. Mm-hmm. That's going to disappear. You know, where Tom Selleck or William Shatner or someone like that tried to make it on the big screen and the audience just didn't warm to them in that way, that they loved them on their Saturday night TV as opposed to going to paying to see them in the cinema. That's not going to happen. Like Leonardo DiCaprio was talking about how movie theaters are going to be closing down. He's very concerned about this. And now his last couple of movies, I think, have gone straight to Netflix. So he's not really a movie star anymore. He's of a traditional sense. He's a streaming star, a TV movie star, or you know that what we grew up with, knowing, is all completely arse about face now. So, I just thought what we could do is we could just do a little news section where if something were to come up in the trades, as they would call it, we could inform each other of what it is and why we think that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of relies on both of us knowing about the stories we're adding to the pile here. And I'm not understanding that up to now. I kind of thought that you would take the lead on this. But my first story I put in was 47 Ronin director found guilty of defrauding Netflix out of $11 million. And the story here, if I can remember since I put it in here, is that the director Carl Rynch, who was behind the 2013 Keanu Reeves movie 47 Ronin, now faces up to 90 years in prison. Oh, the other thing is that since I've added this, it might, the whole story might have changed, I suppose. We need to polish this section up probably already. In 2020, after spending $44 million of Netflix money on the series, Rinch petitioned another $11 million to complete the season. The company agreed. Then things got weird. Instead of Netflix investing to finish the series, Rinch transferred the funds to his personal accounts. This is like Father Ted, isn't it? It was resting in my account. And crypto got involved and he moved the money around where he wasn't supposed to do, allegedly. And so now he's being sued by everyone and their brother, and he might spend 90 years in jail. Do you know any more about this story?
I know that he spent $10 million of it on luxury items, including like Rolls Royces and Ferraris, furniture, and nearly $1 million on mattresses.
Ooh,
how bizarre! Weirdly, and he's going to be sleeping on some of the most uncomfortable mattresses in the country, yeah. I would imagine. But Netflix has cancelled the project back in 2021, and wrote off $55 million.
Wow,
that's insane! This is a whole trade thing. They're doing that an awful lot. You hear about movies that are made, and what is it? Acme versus Wile E. Coyote is a famous one, where it's been made, it's ready to go, but they've decided that if they were to write it off, the tax write off might be larger than what they'll make on the opening weekend. Right. So it might work out in their favor not to release the movie. Which is bonkers, but you know that money kind of has been spent and needs to be accounted for, and things just get more and more complicated.
Mm.
Oh, it's a scary landscape. I'd hate to be an executive in this world.
But I don't know the latest on this story. It might be that something has been resolved, or. You know, I mean, I can't imagine he's going to spend 90 years in prison, even if he lived that long. But there you go. My second,
I could probably get right after a couple of months of good behavior.
Yes. My second story was another one that I'm not too clear about, because it was about Sony buying Peanuts for $460 million. And then after I put this in the group for our new section, possible discussion, I did read somewhere in the week that perhaps this wasn't going through after all. The Snoopy and Charlie Brown thing was owned by this Canadian firm called Wild Brain. At least the majority of the stake was, but Sony want 80% of the stake of the whole thing, and so they're coughing up all this money allegedly to do this. But I don't know if you heard anything else on this story, but this broke this news on the 19th of December, so it was quite some time ago. And I did think that I'd heard something about perhaps it was failing after all.
Well, yeah, it's some sort of it probably takes time for these things to be agreed and rubber stamped and all that kind of stuff. They have a certain amount of time to be able to accept the offer or reject the offer, mull it over and look, because it's not just down to we're buying Peanuts, because Peanuts is a franchise that has all kinds of things. Like there's computer games, there's books, there's previous media, there's future going forward. And that's why things like the Netflix Warner Brothers thing is really, really complicated. And, you know, while Netflix is trying to buy Warner, they're not buying all of Warner. They're buying elements of Warner, so other areas will continue, which is bonkers that, you know, it's not just one thing that they're buying. So it could be something along that those lines, where $460 million sounds like an awful lot of money. So it probably is everything encompassing. Whereas the people who own it right now are probably going, well, what can we keep? Well, you know, how much is it actually worth to us? You know, should we do this? So they'll go away and evaluate that. And then monopolies and mergers and things like that have to come along and have a look and see whether or not it's viable to actually push this through, you know, or are there other interested parties? You have to give other people other options to purchase as well, where it can become a bidding war and all that kind of stuff. So it'll take a while before it eventually.
So it could be, it could take a year. It could actually be bouncing around being talked about after the story's broken a year later, still nothing's happened.
Well, you didn't take the opportunity to go for the pun, but you know, $460 million is hardly peanuts.
Yeah, thank you. And my last story is Mickey Rourke, who I didn't recognise in this picture. Blimey. He denounces the fact that apparently his back-end staff had tried to raise some money in order to bail him out or something.
He was going to be lose his house and stuff like that. They set up a GoFundMe for $60,000.
And apparently, according to the story, his back-end staff had started this fund to try and raise money from. And the Hollywood Reporter is reporting that that he's fuming about this. He knew nothing about it, even though his staff are saying they were told to do it by him. And he's saying, no, you weren't. I would never ask for money from my fans. And, you know, there's an impasse here. But I was more interested in what he looks like, to be honest. It's a very strange picture of him, but it's a far cry from his 1980s days, isn't it?
It is. You didn't watch him in, what was it, Bad Brother or Big Brother he was in earlier last year?
No.
I think he was in a few episodes of that, or was it Celebrity Big Brother? Or
certainly not.
Regular? I can't remember. I watched a couple of episodes of it, and he was Mickey Rourke. You know, you can't expect him to be cool, and he's just always a bit weird. So, yeah, this is an odd one, but I think this is probably his staff trying to retain their jobs. Because if he isn't able to like make his mortgage payment or whatever, pay the lease on whatever property he has, then how is he going to be able to pay their salaries and things? You know, that could be why they've set it up to try and support him and keep him alive so that they don't have to go back on the job market.
In the middle of all this, apparently he said that he's gone on record as saying he was terrible at maintaining finances throughout his whole career. His net worth is supposed to be about $5 million. He says, I did a terrible job managing my career. I wasn't very diplomatic. I had to go to 20 years of therapy to get over that. and so by his own admission, he's managed money very badly. It all sounds a bit of a pot boiler.
Yeah. I like Mickey Rourke. I really do. I think his contribution to cinema over the years is, it's phenomenal, you know, and I hope that he manages to navigate his way and as his career continues in some respect.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I threw in a couple of stories that I felt were kind of interesting because Deadline produced an article regarding some of the most watched TV programs in Britain over 2025, because I'm always interested to see what exactly people are watching. I grew up knowing that Knight Rider and The A-Team were the most popular things on TV. They weren't, but that's what I thought they were because that's what I was watching. Whereas, you know, Keeping Up Appearances and Last of the Summer Wine or those were the popular things. So the interesting thing now is what is popular today. And you know, Celebrity Traders appears to be the big thing that everyone was tuning in to watch this year, which is massive. You know, at the 10.8 million people tuned in to see that, and it secured the TV show Traders secured three of the top 10 spots, Race Across the World doing the same, which is another kind of reality show as well. That Netflix crime drama Adolescence became one of the top titles as well with 13.2 million viewers. And that movie by Richard Osman, wrote the book, The Thursday Murder Club, got 10 million viewers, which is, you know, that's a TV movie. There you go, it's a movie for TV on Netflix. But Netflix dominated the streaming with 8 out of the top 10 series, top 10 movies and series and of most watched this year, which is, that just goes to show that they are the number one thing. BBC didn't do too badly. Obviously, they own Celebrity Traders, and they had the New Year's Eve fireworks where 13.3 million people tuned in to watch that. Why? I don't get that, but I suppose they did. I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of There was there as well. The Great British Bake Off. If you remember Gavin and Stacey, A Fond Farewell, that was at the start of the year, wasn't it? I think that was New Year's Day or something.
I actually haven't seen that, but I do know what Gavin and Stacey is. Unlike everything else in this list, apart from Adolescence, I have no idea what any of this is. I never watch live TV. The Thursday Murder Club is a film on Netflix. That's different, I suppose. Adolescence is on Netflix, so that's different. But everything else on that list, without exception, I've no idea what they are. And it all to me looks like light entertainment claptrap, which I would steer completely clear of. I'm amazed that so many people must just sit down, you know, royal family style, in the evening, after work, after dinner, and just sit and vegetate in front of crap on the television.
Well, you didn't look hard enough, did you? Because Wednesday was there with 6.8 million.
That's a different list. I'm looking at the TV, the best film, the series and TV on the top one in here. You've gone down to the second one, which is the top 10 series in streaming. Now, that's a bit different. You're quite right. Wednesday's there, and I know what that is. But, again, and I know what Stranger Things is as well, but I don't really want to watch it. But again, in that list, there's nothing that I would want to watch in there, particularly that buffoon Clarkson on his farm. It's the last thing I would watch. And then there's films in streaming. I stand a bit more chance with this, I suppose, because most of that stuff is Netflix. In fact, nine out of the ten is Netflix, and one is Disney Plus.
Films on streaming, they're really important whenever you compare them to the box office as well, because you get to see, like, Happy Gilmore 2 came in second after The Thursday Murder Club at 6.7 million on Netflix, and then Moana 2 on Disney Plus at 5.4 million. And if you try to work that out, you know, you don't have a box office figure where people are buying cinema tickets to go in, which have, you know, the cost of the cinema or the commission of the cinema removed and that kind of thing. You can't really work out how much money this has made, because it's Disney Plus making Moana 2, dumping it on their streaming so that they can sell subscriptions. So only a percentage of the subscription actually goes toward the actual final figure. So they can just see their subscriptions going up or subscriptions going down. You know, Amazon Prime doesn't appear on the streaming list at all, which I think is very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And I would say that a lot of people might have Amazon Prime, but they're not bothering with the TV side of things because they've introduced the adverts. And I'm wondering if they got rid of those adverts, would we start to see people starting to tune into Amazon Prime because they're happy enough to pick out the cheaper bundle that has the free delivery on their products. So I'd love to see them or be a fly on a wall in one of those executive meetings where they're going, we didn't get in the top 10 at all with some of the projects that we've put out. And they put out some really big films this year.
There's also Apple, isn't there, which are completely missing. And the way that we talk about Apple products on this very show over the last year, I think there's some really good quality streaming films and TV shows in there, which we've all watched. But not a sniff of them.
No. Bit bizarre. But Squid Game wasn't there.
No. Yeah, that's a Netflix thing, isn't it, Squid Game?
Yeah, and people went mad for it the year before, but season two, they cooled off. So it is, it's flash in the pan. It's just like the box office in that way, where, you know, one movie can do really well one year, and then they release a sequel, and it falls flat, because people just aren't interested anymore. They've moved on.
Wow.
Yeah. So moving on to something I think is much more exciting, and that would be a lost movie that might be coming back.
Yeah.
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre has one sort of sequel that has never actually been released. And a lot of people know about it, but a lot of people don't know about it. But there's a movie called All American Massacre that was made by Toby Hooper's son, William Hooper. And it featured one of the characters from Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, played by Bill Moseley, called Chop Top. And it was a sequel to Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, but also included like a prequel type part where it would a character origin story, essentially, would be what it was. And it was, I believe it's only an hour long, because it was never fully finished. But it could all stuck with money problems and things like that, and licensing problems, so it never actually got released. It never got finished even. But it's a really interesting timepiece, and it's actually been one that's been rumored. There wasn't really too much evidence to suggest that it actually existed. There was a bootleg trailer, and there were some images and things, but people didn't quite believe that it was fully there because they couldn't see it, so why would they believe it? But recently, and I have to throw credit out to Planet CHH on YouTube, because he filled in a lot of blanks for me, because I've been following his coverage of this over the last year. An eBay auction came up where someone was selling materials, VHS materials, in relation to this, and the eBay auction was won by someone, and they actually seem to be doing something with the elements that they received from that purchase. And if you go to Cinebacker, you can see information on the project and how we could, within the next year, have a new sequel to Texas Chainsaw Massacre featuring Bill Moseley as Chop Top. Which is really exciting. It's a rumor that's actually come to life, and a lost piece of media that has been found, and it could have hopefully be restored in some way that's not going to be, you know, all AI or poorly generated or something like that, and restored and sold as a beautiful collector's item. This is really exciting. And you've never heard of All American Massacre, Ted?
No, and no. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I saw when it first came out, when I was a much younger person. And to be honest with you, I can remember very little about it. If this is coming along, I think I need to go and re-watch. When did you last see Texas Chainsaw?
About 3-4 months ago. A big 4K box set from Studio Canal. Oh, what a wonderful film.
Is it? I just can't remember. I mean, I remember the famous, you know, imagery and iconry involved in it, but I think I need to go and watch it again, especially if this is coming along. Is this like anytime soon, or is it just a complete rumour?
Oh, no, it's if you click through to Cinebacker, I don't think they have any dates on it, but you can pledge to help with the restoration and things like that. So far, it's raised £11,500, and the goal is £75,000 for them to fully do it. Cinebacker seem to be doing a couple of other things as well. I've noticed there was a Return of the Living Dead game and follow-up movie based around Linnea Quigley's character that they've got on there, and Driller Killer 2, which is something that they're looking for £75,000 for as well. Yeah. But don't know. You can get your name in the credits, which would be pretty phenomenal. For 75 quid, you can get your name in the credits of a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie.
Excellent.
Okay. Yeah. That's exciting. I think I'm looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. All we need is that other vacation movie, because there's a, was it All American or American Adventure? What's the lost National Lampoon's Vacation movie with Chevy Chase and Beverly D'Angelo to be released one day?
Mm-hmm.
Possibly. And the last thing we could talk about is the Oscars, because it's that time of year whenever the Oscar run is happening. And we've got a bunch of movies that are going to be the big hitters at the Oscars. We've got DiCaprio's One Battle After Another, a film which I haven't actually got around to seeing yet. Have you seen it?
No, I have not. I don't really fancy it, to be honest, but I'll give it a go.
Okay. There's Hamnet. Hamnet.
That's not actually arrived yet. I am looking forward to that. I think it's at risk of being very arty-farty. And even though, what's her name's in it?
Rose Byrne?
No. what's her name? I can't remember her name. Anyway, even though there's a cast that I am attracted to, I do fear that because of the subject matter, it might be very arty-farty and all actors being lovies together. But we'll see.
Jesse Buckley.
That's the one. I can never remember. One of the things that you're going to have to know going forward with Alan missing is I can't remember actors' names. You'll have to prompt me every time. Do carry on.
I'll try. But it's always a bit of a thing whenever it comes to the Oscar run. There'll be two or three films that you've heard of, although that haven't actually come out yet, that have been held back until the Oscar run. And then they come out and everyone's going, wow, this is amazing. And you're like, well, why haven't we heard of this before? Like Sentimental Value, which stars Stellan Skarsgård and Ellie Fanning, is on the image? I think so. There's Marty Supreme as well. But there's one for horror lovers, and that's Sinners. Sinners is on there, which I'm quite impressed with, although I haven't seen it. But I might go and watch it now because it's a horror film. It Was Just an Accident is there too, and that that Frankenstein one that people thought was okay by Del Toro.
Yeah.
You watched that, didn't you?
I did, and I thought it was all right. We spoke, if you remember, about the dodgy CGI when the dogs, the wolves, turn up, and it was just laughably poor. Christoph Waltz was really good in it, and he almost made it worth watching. It was all right, don't get me wrong. It was just that they could have spent some more money on the CGI. That would have made a big difference.
Oscar batter?
I don't understand what that means.
would be something that would get Oscars, do you think? Would you expect Best Picture of the Year award goes to Frankenstein?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it was that good. It was all right. It just wasn't that great. I think that the previous Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, I think, was better, even though it was much older and different in different ways.
Okay. There's Train Dreams, Avatar 3, I think that is. I can't remember. One of the Avatars. Mm-hmm. Begonia, which is one you like.
Yeah, I did like that. And I reviewed that, and we spoke about it on the show. And I hope that does get something. But it probably won't, because it's a bit off the wall, isn't it?
Yeah. That Wicked sequel, The Secret Agent, which I haven't heard of, but I'm intrigued. If I'd Had Legs, I'd Kick You.
Oh, that looks really boring. A woman whining about her surroundings in her life, surrounded by kids who are also whining, and, oh, good grief.
Okay. Blue Moon, Weapons, K-Pop Demon Hunters, which is a bit of a novel one. No Other Choice, which I heard was a disaster. The Smashing Machine, Testament of Anne Lee, J. Kelly, which looked fucking terrible. A House of Dynamite, which looks pretty stiffing.
I thought that was good. Yeah, we spoke about that.
Yeah.
And also Weapons, which you mentioned. I liked Weapons. I thought the ending was a bit disappointing. Again, we spoke about it on the show, so we've done that. But the House of Dynamite, I thought, was good.
Die My Love with Jennifer Lawrence, apparently getting her kid off, which is unusual, apparently. Mm. After The Hunt with Julia Roberts, which again I heard was pretty bad. But, well, that's the list there, the front runners. I can't say I'm too excited about very many of them. I'll give the horror films a shake, and I think that will be enough.
Yeah, I'm not particularly blown away by any of that, to be honest. But we'll see what happens. When the Oscars? At the end of February, is it? I think it is.
Well, you get the Golden Globes first, and that'll be a good indicator as to what's going to win the Oscars.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We'll see what happens. No doubt we'll be talking about that as time goes on. We're half an hour into the show now. We're going to have to fly through these mini reviews from our listeners, because otherwise this show's going to be 3 hours long. That news section has, it's done what it usually does on Tech Addicts, which is take all the time up. Let's quickly fly through some of these feedback from people, starting with Chad.
Okay, Chad Dixon's written in about Amber Alert. What would you do if you got an Amber Alert on your phone regarding a child abduction in your area? This is a great little thriller based on true events. With the time running out of just 90 minutes, it hooks you from the first scene and keeps you gripped. I take it that's a hacked-down version of Chad's review there, Ted.
Yeah, no, it wasn't a proper review. It was just his notes in the group. But I disagreed with him, actually. I watched this, and he obviously thought it was better than I did. For me, it played out very much like a TV movie from Channel 5 or something. I didn't think it was very well produced or acted, and I wasn't gripped in the way that he was. But, you know, each to their own, and fine, I'm glad he enjoyed it. The strength lies in the truth of the scheme and the story about this area in America where they've set this scheme up to deal with child abduction, and the figures relating to that are quite shocking, to be honest. You know, what a place America must be with all these child abductions going on, which have been in that area 1,300 over 28 years. 28 years is a long time, fair enough, but it's still an awful lot. Anyway, there you go. That's Amber Alert, 2024 film, which is available on Netflix. Adrian Brain is next on The Last Frontier, 2025, on Apple TV. Imagine a mashup of the film Con Air and Northern Exposure, he says, and you'll get a passable detective action-adventure series. A prison transport plane chock full of orange-suited clad convicts crashes in Alaska, and it's up to the local U.S. Marshal, played by Jason Clarke, to round up the many surviving slags before they do much too much damage to the local population. Top CIA agent turns up, determined to capture super bad crim Dominic Cooper, but as the action unfolds, it soon becomes clear there's a lot more to this scenario than just a simple accident. There's a lot to like here, an above average script, stunning locations, and Jason Clarke. Unfortunately, it's let down by a ludicrous plot, breathtakingly stupid teenagers, and a performance by Hayley Bennett that is more wooden than the entire fir tree forest of Alaska. So Adrian says, watchable, but nothing special.
Okay, I fully disagree. I love this, actually. This really just ticked the boxes for me. I'm pretty sure I talked about this on the show.
Yeah, you did. And I on the back of what you said, I watched the first episode. And to be fair, the first episode seemed to be all right to me, okay. But obviously, Adrian's watched it all. Have you watched it all?
I've got one episode left to go, and I don't want to watch it just yet. I just want to... I want to find out if there's going to be a season two before I do watch it. I don't know why. It's a bit stupid, like, but now I say it out loud, but I'm holding off watching it.
Okay.
But Chad Dixon has also written in about Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery, which he says, another great ensemble cast with solid performances by all, especially Daniel Craig as Super Sleuth, Benoit. Excuse me, I've seen the first one, and I don't know the character's name. With that brilliant Foghorn Leghorn accent. Some may not like the religious backdrop to this plot. The ending did seem to be a bit more convoluted than was really necessary. Still an entertaining watch. Congratulations to Rian Johnson for bringing us another great whodunit film. So thanks, Chad. That's a third in the series, isn't it?
I think it is, yeah. And I asked Chad if I needed to watch the second one before I watched the third one, and he said, no, not really. You can just jump straight into the third one.
But I thought you had seen this third one. Does it not have Ana de Armas?
No, that's the first one. The first one's got Ana de Armas. So that's the one I leapt at, and it was all right. I was only watching it for her, but it was all right. And I haven't got to the second one because she wasn't in it. Okay, now, talking about pronouncing things badly, I've no idea how to pronounce this. Adrian Brain on...
Osiris.
Osiris, thank you. I've no idea what the word means. The big draw for this recent sci-fi action...
God of the Night or something, isn't it? Sorry.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yeah. The big draw for this recent sci-fi actioner is Linda Terminator Hamilton, but sadly, her on-screen time is less than 10 minutes. What's worse, she didn't so much phone in the performance as send in a fax of Sarah Connor with a note, I'll add a silly Russian accent in the overdub. Oh, well, I expect she has bills to pay, too. The actual lead in the film is called, I kid you not, Max Martini, says Adrian. The square jaw action hero's square jaw. He plays the commander of a special forces unit that is abducted mid-mission into the bowels of an alien spaceship. After the usual probing of the rubbery-looking aliens, they are sealed up in jelly. They are museum exhibits presenting the best warriors Earth has to offer. However, the jelly melts and our heroes are free to try to prevent the aliens from eating the population of the Earth. If you watch the trailer, you've seen the film, basically. Lots of running around alien spaceship corridors, which look remarkably samey. And the expected death by numbers. Sadly, key points such as the final battle between Uber Alien and Earth's squarest jaw are fluffed badly, says Adrian. However, I did enjoy this, despite it being rubbish. Max Martini, often shaken and not stirred, carries the film with a certain bravado, and it's always good to see Linda Hamilton with a big gun, no matter how briefly, currently streaming on platforms in the UK. So thank you for that. Have you seen this? You like the whole Terminator thing, don't you?
I do, actually, and I'll be coming back to it later in the show. I remember this coming out, or the trailer arriving. We might have actually featured it, or maybe it didn't make the cut, but I don't know that I could tolerate it. So thanks, Adrian, for taking one for the team there. It does look fun, but it just doesn't look as enjoyable as good old-fashioned 80s and 90s sci-fi junk. And throwing Linda Hamilton in doesn't really work anymore for me. I'll maybe give it a go if it was to come on. I've got absolutely nothing else to watch, but otherwise I'll just take Adrian's warning about it.
Yeah, being rubbish.
Yeah. Well, a fellow called Chad Dixon, I don't know, have you heard him before?
This has been an Adrian Brain Chad Dixon sandwich, hasn't it? Do carry on.
It has been. What an interesting sandwich. Chad Dixon has written in on Goodbye June, which is on Netflix. And he says this is the directorial debut for Kate Winslet. Her son, Joe Anders, provided the screenplay. It's an English family drama in which four siblings try to deal with the terminal illness of their mother and odd behavior of their father. There's a family infighting and day-to-day chaos of large groups of children in the lead-up to Christmas. The ensemble cast does sterling acting jobs. However, I would suggest that you only watch it if you have someone who has dealt well with grief. If you are someone who has dealt well with grief, I find it frustrating to watch people dealing with it badly. But it is a well-told story that is set mostly in a hospital environment. Thanks, Chad. I'll avoid that entirely. It sounds awful. Sounds Ted, dreadful. I actually think that you probably like it.
No, I think that Kate, I do like Kate Winslet, and I'm okay with English drama, but that sounds really drab and sad. And but maybe that's partly the point. Perhaps I should watch it. Okay, I will.
Oh, it's got Timothy Spall and Helen Mirren.
Yeah, it's the whole crew in there, isn't it? Yeah. It's got the whole kind of Kate Winslet crowd in there, hasn't it? But and in that respect, with a good cast, you think, yeah, fair enough, okay. Anyway, yeah, I will give it a go because you're quite right, I should. And we love Kate Winslet, don't we? Now, we decided to slip in a new section here. When this is still going to be a three-hour show. New section called Fandom Focus. The idea here was to take where there's something to talk about. We don't have to do it every time. Something that is, we want to talk about in terms of being a fan of something. And it is well documented, I'm a fan of Dick Van Dyke. And in December, he was 100 years old. And I just thought I would accolade that because I've been watching him getting closer and closer to 100, hoping over the last 2 or 3 years that he would make it. And he did, so good for him. And just a little bit of background, he didn't get into film. He'd done stage work before, but he didn't get into film until he was nearly 40. There's a film called Bye Bye Birdie, which I've now grabbed and I need to watch. I haven't seen it, but that was the story that he did on the stage, and they decided to make it into a film and used him from the stage on the film to do it with. So that was cool. Then he got his big breakthrough, which was with Mary Poppins in 1964 with Julianne Andrews, and then Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and that was the thing that I knew the most with Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and my introduction really to Dick Van Dyke. And as a child, I completely adored Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. As I've said on the show before, it's a staggeringly standout childhood memory for me, and I can watch and watch and watch and watch it, and I never get fed up with it. There's always something to thrill and to enjoy. Just pure nostalgia. So anyway, in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, he was actually older than his grandfather. So if we take the Caractacus character that he played, the actor Dick Van Dyke was older than Lionel Jeffries, who was playing his grandfather, which is very funny, only by a few months apparently, but it was quite an interesting thing because they've made granddad look to be much older, of course. I think he survives pretty much all of the Chitty cast, actually, maybe apart from the kids. I think the kids are still alive, but I think everyone else has gone. He's gone on record as saying that he loved doing Mary Poppins, despite his dodgy and infamous Cockney accent, which was terrible, which he admits, but he says that's a real highlight of his career. He told people at Chitty that he wouldn't do it again, so his American accent, if you watch Chitty Bang Bang, he retains his American accent and doesn't try to do a London one, which would fit more in with the storyline. But anyway, then he did a lot of American TV, really, and a lot of that, I think, passed us by in this country. It certainly passed me by when I was a kid. The Dick Van Dyke Show, 61 to 66, the new Dick Van Dyke Show. I did watch a couple of episodes of that, and it's kind of amusing. It's funny. He goes a bit slapstick with it. He's always, you know, kind of falling over things. Physical comedy, which he based on the work of Stan Laurel, he says. And you can see what he's trying to do in there. The big one for him, well, the longest running one, though, looks like Diagnosis Murder, which he did when he was 67. But lots and lots of appearances all over the place. He even appeared at the age of 92 in Mary Poppins Returns, which is quite funny. And not just appearing, but a singing and dancing role in that as well, at the age of 92. He had a booze problem, which he overcame, and he smoked 40 fags a day for 50 years. So there you go. Obviously, smoking is good for you, although he has now quit. And he had four children with his long-life partner, Michelle Triola, who apparently is an actress as well. I wasn't aware of her, though. And his funniest quote in recent times is, "I've retired so many times now, it's getting to be a habit." So I loved Dick Van Dyke, and so did my sisters, and we loved the films, Mary Poppins as well, and he will always have a very special place in our TV viewing and film viewing, and really appreciate it, Tim. You're probably not old enough as me to have plugged into that nostalgia. You were too busy watching Boss Hogg by then.
I obviously know Dick Van Dyke quite well from the likes of Mary Poppins and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, but I haven't watched them since I was knee-high to a grasshopper. Yeah. So I can't say that I know him terribly well anymore. I did try, because we discussed him on one of the previous shows in the other section, the private screening section, theme treats. And I went looking to see if I could find something that he was in that really appealed to me, like an action thriller or something like that, to see whether or not he'd done something like that. I couldn't.
No,
you know, he's such a clean-cut guy. He's always made sort of family-friendly comedies and dramas and things that that are family first. There's very few who are like that. There's always someone who's done something somewhere that's a wee bit out of the mould. But aside from Dick Van Dyke.
Anyway, congratulations to him. I know he'll be listening to our podcast. He's the fifth person.
Well, maybe he could come on and replace Alan. If you're free, let's talk.
Right, flop of the fortnight. I haven't got anything. Have you?
I do, yes. Obviously, Christmas happened. I don't know if you noticed, but there was a whole Christmassy thing, and you're off work, and you sit down and watch family movies and stuff like that. And in exchange for watching, you know, the obligatory Scrooged and Die Hards and things like that, we had to appease my wife, and she insisted that we watch Sleepless in Seattle. And I didn't object because I'm a bit of a fan of Rob Reiner, and I know he's in it, and I haven't seen this since, VHS, I think. But I have to say, it is just the worst. It's a film that, you know, it uses every get-out-of-jail-free card in any possible conflict, and it really, really irks me. I'll give you one example. You know, the Meg Ryan's character is engaged to someone else, and they're talking about getting married, but she's fallen in love with some twat over in Seattle. And she sits down and has dinner, and the writers have just taken the easy thing and just gone, right, okay, her husband-to-be, Bill Pullman, we're just going to make him a nice guy, and he's going to understand, because love. No way. He'd be throwing her clothes out the window, selling her jewelry down the second-hand shop, cash converters, and getting really annoyed at her and things like that, and calling her friends and telling her that she's a slut and all that kind of stuff. And then Tom Hanks's character, his son, pre-9/11, I'll give you that, gets on a flight on his own and flies from Seattle to Manhattan. I don't know if you know your geography, but that's quite far. That's like 3,000 miles, give or take 1,000 miles. And he goes there, and Tom Hanks follows him there. Obviously concerned about his son's welfare, but not entirely, you know, furious that his son has gone and booked this plane ticket. I think it's at Christmas or Thanksgiving or something like that, one of the busiest times of the year. And he's having to go do the same thing and get on to the next flight possible, which probably would have cost him an absolute fortune as well, and go there. And I sat there thinking, oh my word, the writers of this film are just treating the audience like complete and utter dummies. I really felt it was just a a waste of time. It was just garbage. Garbage to satisfy people. Meg Ryan, I like. I've liked her in many, many movies. But this one, no. She is sort of kooky and unhinged. And it never develops that. If you watch her mannerisms whenever she's talking to people, you can't help but think there's something wrong with this girl. There really is. And she and Bill Pullman's character are actually well-suited, better suited than Tom Hanks's character, because he's so laid back and relaxed. I can't imagine the two of them working in the slightest. Carrie Lowell turns up as well for 2 minutes. You've got Carrie Lowell in your film and you do nothing with her. That's absolute sin. You shouldn't be allowed to do that in the slightest. David Hyde Pierce is in it just to deliver a couple of lines. You know who else is in here? Better Call Saul. What's his name? Bob Odenkirk.
Is he?
And his voice is bizarre. He's got this really deep voice. He's in one scene.
Oh, right.
I don't know if it's really early in his filmography or something, but he's got one scene, and whenever he speaks, you're like, that's not Bob Odenkirk. It looks a bit like him, but it's not him. No, it is. And according to the credits, it is.
Wow.
Well, this movie, just I think it needs to die a death and be forgotten about entirely. It needs to be garroted in Seattle. Yeah. Have you ever seen this shit? Sorry, this movie?
I have seen this film at least twice, and I completely disagree. And I think that it's okay in terms of a fantasy story to detach yourself from reality, and that writers can get away with stuff because it's just all fuzzy fantasy stuff. It's not supposed to be real. It's just a feel-good, gloopy kind of feel-good story which touches the heart, a heartwarming tale. And you're approaching it like you would, critically some sort of horror film or something, and holding it up to close scrutiny. I think you're doing it disjustice. I can't find Bob Odenkirk in here. Are you sure he's in it? I don't remember him being in it.
He's one of the members of either of their family, and they're playing a game in the living room together, and he speaks. Oh, no, it's whenever. No.
I've been looking through the cast list.
I'm getting confused. No, he's not in here. He's in Cable Guy.
Cable Guy.
Yes.
What's right.
The next time.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
But yes.
That's the way he is in Cable Guy.
you're completely right in terms of it being sickly sweet, and I can see why people could be annoyed with it if they're not in the right mood. And, you know, I dare say it's a kind of girly flick as well. And the little brat is really annoying at times. But I think that's missing the point. I think it's supposed to be those things. And you watch it in that frame of mind to soak up the nonsense fantasy involved. And, yeah, the whole Christmas thing, because it's all centered around this kind of Christmas thing. I think you're giving it a hard time.
No, I think it's given women in America and men in America this ridiculous fantasy that this sort of thing is acceptable. It's far from it. Bill Pullman's character would not react that way. Not at all.
Fair enough. Nope. Okay. Now, talking about fantasy, we're going into private screening now. And even though Alan is missing, I've got some notes from him about Pluribus. I challenged us to, or didn't need much challenging, really. I don't know how far you got through with it, but Alan and I watched the whole thing. It was on Apple TV. There was 9 episodes, and it's this surreal drama, which probably everyone in the world knows about now. And it was just an interesting watch, I think. I totally enjoyed it. I think Alan's notes kind of sum it up for me as well. One of the best shows in years, he says.
What you have to do is you have to do an impersonation of Alan in order to effectively put this across and spell his name correctly.
You'll have to do that then with your... similar accent. One of the best shows in years, he says. Landmark science fiction. Intelligent, terrifying and funny. Great acting and artistry throughout. I genuinely savoured every scene. The writers skillfully balanced plot and subtext. It's brimming with fascinating insights into modern society, but without ever hitting us over the head with clunky symbolism. The show's subtlety invites reflection rather than ramming home insights. I'm glad they had the confidence to take their time and not rush the story, especially given how much happens in the first two episodes. No matter how outlandish the scenario, the cast remain utterly convincing throughout. In particular, Ray Seahorn's depiction of Carol's fresh heartbreak and her quietly simmering genocidal rage was extraordinary. Carlos Manuel Vesca plays Monusos as a man of mythical resolve, whose fiery moral clarity is as bewildering as it is admirable. He is both heroic and preposterous, but not in equal measure. Zosia, who I've fallen in love with now, lead recruiter for the interplanetary cultists, is played to perfection by Carolina Wydra, who manages to blend fervour with disarming allure. I fear I would betray my species all too readily should pan-galactic union with Zosia be up for grabs. He agrees with me. The observation that loved ones may be more dangerous than our enemies is sobering indeed. It's only a pity that we may have to endure an actual alien invasion before we get to enjoy season two, assuming the three of us survive, of course. So yeah, the story behind that is that they're talking about season two is coming, but it's likely to be 2027. They're really going to take their time with it. This is a masterwork from Vince Gilligan, I think, and the reason I highlighted Ray is because I didn't know this up till now, but Rhea Seahorn, her first name she pronounces as Ray, R-A-Y, so I learned something there. And this is Gilligan's first return to television since Breaking Bad, and it's a very strange story, off the wall. Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul are much more structured in a sense than this. It's the story about the Earth being invaded by a bunch of aliens, but in such a way that it takes over the human bodies, and there's only 13 people left who have not been infected by the way in which they have been able to infect everyone else. And the infection makes people nice and cooperative and accommodating and do anything to help each other. It was like, it's like hippie land on Earth. But the story is that our central character, Ray Seahorn, Carol, is kicking against this and is trying really hard to find a way out of it, while all the time behind the scenes, the aliens are working on a way to fix their problem that they had with these 13 people and find a way to get them to be like the rest of them. It's fascinating watch. It really is. There's so many deep dive kind of simile stuff going on and ideas being banded around. And also, if you start to dig deeper, I was watching some YouTube videos about it. You know what these various reviewers were looking into and tying up with other works of Gilligan's and the symbolism and the facts and stuff about the universe, and it's just absolutely fascinating. And I was bowled over by it, and I don't know that I've ever given a film or a show in private screening full marks, but I think that I'm going to have to with this. It's just so good. So watch it if you haven't. Pay for an Apple TV subscription just to watch it, because it blew me away. Now, you're going to tell me that it's crap, aren't you?
Well, I have to say I've only seen two episodes. I started watching it just the other night because I was finishing off two other shows. But I thoroughly enjoyed what I saw. To be honest, the first two episodes, as Alan had said, packed in an awful lot of stuff. And I felt that it spent a lot of time doing some menial things. I'm not saying this in a negative way, but I'm wondering if perhaps it's not going to be as infinitely rewatchable as Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul, because, you know, the likes of, in the first episode, there's this sequence where Carol puts her friend on a sandwich board and in the back of a van or a truck and then drives to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And that occupies a significant amount of time. I was wondering if there was going to be a point to it, and I was waiting in a tension factor for the character to wake up or something like that, and for something to happen, but it doesn't come, and that made me think that, you know, this isn't as gripping in a rewatchable way, whereas both Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul are something that you pine to rewatch. I don't know that I'm going to pine to rewatch that first episode. In fact, if I was to get through Pluribus and love it as much as you do, I might skip over the first episode because it takes its time.
It does, absolutely. It's a slow burn in many places. In many of the episodes, it's a slow burn. But I would absolutely watch it again. And I just would remind you that there was lots of episodes in Breaking Bad where the same thing happened. It got really slow. And in the first series of Breaking Bad, some people that I've spoken to almost have given up on it because it's really slow. You remember the episode in Breaking Bad where they are trying to catch the fly in the in the lab. Well, that they took the whole episode just doing that. Nothing else happened in that episode except that, and that was him focusing in. That scene you're talking about with Carol taking the body on the sign in the back of the truck, it's interesting you should pick that out, because somebody on a YouTube video had picked that apart, and Gilligan himself mentioned how they had gone to great lengths to film that in the way they had, and the reasons why they'd done it, and artistically, if you look behind what was going on there, you know, you'll just see more in it. I think you need to give it more of a chance and perhaps to dig a bit deeper into yourself.
Oh, no, absolutely. I'm looking forward to watching an episode whenever we get done with this epic show. And I'll feedback slowly over the course of the year. But no, it's a very well produced, and it's obviously got all the money in the world to throw at it. So it's got to deliver. I think it's got a lot of weight on its shoulders, and I was a bit concerned going into it, going, this appears to be Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but then it's Invasion of the Body Snatchers, a well tried and tested story, and then some. They've taken it further. They've thrown more imagination into it, and that's something that really sells to me particularly, because it is a story I love, and they've gone the extra mile with it. And given that that's the first episode, pretty much, and then the second episode develops on that, and then I can't wait to see what the next 8 episodes? There's 10, isn't
there? There's 9. Total? There's 9.
9?
Yeah.
Oh, the cheap bastards. Right. No, I am very much enjoying it. I'm not going to give it a full 15, but I will happily give it a 10 out of 15 if you want to score it.
Okay, so I'm going to give it 15, the top mark, and I'm not convinced that I've done that, as I say before, but I honestly think that this is worth it, which gives it a score of 25. But if you, I think that maybe you might in future come back and we'll adjust that score when you can enjoy
more of it.
Well,
I can say that this will be the first time you scored anything 15.
Yes, just to explain, with Alan gone, we want to keep the scoring intact, and so we're going to score out of 15 for the two of us to keep the total 30, if you follow. So, yeah, which is very logical. Right, now...
Rather than converting them all to 20... Which is doable, Ted went, no, that's far too much math.
Far too much work.
Yeah, I could do it.
And also, when Alan comes to visit us, we'll be able to just drop down to the old scheme easily and quickly, and he can slot in. Right, now, going forward, we decided that in private screening we're going to do about. So I'm going to pick the next one, but I haven't done it yet. So not that anyone will give a flying fart about that, because no one ever tells me what they thought of our private screening shows in the group. So it won't really matter a jot. But I will pick something for us to watch on the next show, and I'll let you know, Gareth, and we'll go forward on that. In the meantime, we started...
It'll be a surprise. Ooh, how interesting.
I'll tell you what it is within 24 hours, I promise. in the meantime, we've got a new theme treats topic for 2026, and it's horror. And we decided that we would... challenge each other over the now that the lily livered Alan's gone, we can watch loads of interesting horror films, and you're the master of this. I picked one for our first one. Sorry, just to explain, it doesn't have to be a film. It can be a person, a director, an actor, a style, whatever, just something to do with horror. It just so happens on this first one, I stumbled into this film called Eyes Without a Face from 1960, and it looked really interesting, so I thought that I would pick this, and so we start off with a film, but next time it may not be a film, so watch this space, but it will be to do with horror. Right. Hopefully you watched the film by now, Gareth, and can tell us all about it and what you thought.
I did. To be entirely honest, I've seen it before, but I forgot. It didn't grab me immediately. The other point of it was I hadn't realized it was subtitled as well, so I tried to watch it whilst I was working, which wasn't really very successful. It's a pretty superb little movie, and I'll give people an idea, because this has been released on the Criterion label on physical media, so it is one of those films that is worth seeing. It was a little horror film that was released in 1960 under the title Les Yeux Sans Visage, and it holds, I think it's 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, so it's an up there horror film. Some may disagree with it actually being a horror film, but they're just stupid. It's considered a bit of a classic, and it falls under a particular genre called poetic horror. Because it's an incredibly beautiful movie, and it uses very soft, dreamlike cinematography. But the storyline of it is rather gruesome, so it's bizarre, you know, in that way that's why poetic horror kind of works, because it's something beautiful with something horrible and all that. But it's about a girl who's involved in a car accident and loses her face, and her parents go to the nth degree to replace her face. The father's kind of doing the operating thing, and the mother's off picking a new face, you know, shopping for a new face, which I thought was cool. But it turned heads, because in 1960 it was particularly graphic, and I think a lot of people hadn't quite expected the level of actual body horror that's going on here. But then it really resonated with people, because it had such an emotional core as well, and it's hard because it's such a horrible, tragic story about parents kind of push to restore the daughter's loss of identity, I think you probably say is the what she's suffering from, because the idea of losing your face is terrifying, and there's quite a lot of dialogue about that, about how it affects her, and the ghostly mask that she has to wear as she's walking around the house is really resounding how it works, because the actress has to play, whose name I've completely forgotten because I'm trying to form my words, her eyes have to do all of the acting, and she's essentially got a completely emotionless face, And for that, she gives a phenomenal performance. And it really adds to the ghostly effect of the film, because she is wearing this mask that is, it's very pretty. It's very nice, very plain. And it just means that she can't change her facial expressions as she's reacting to things as she slips around the house. The pacing of it is very, very slow because it's a French art house movie, and it's very deliberate in that kind of way. And I think it was actually quite influential on other films that were coming along at the time, and it's got that kind of that new wave feel, the French New Wave, which was a cinematic movement back around that time. So it really helps anyone who's sitting down to watch this that is looking for kind of fast-paced action or continual scares. They're going to be shit out of luck here, because it's going to be really boring to them. I really love this movie. It's an excellent film, and I would fully recommend it to anyone who's looking for something, a little bit of a change of pace, and you want to sit down and have a deep horror experience where you can identify with the loss that the lead character actually has to go through. And I think that core is more terrifying than anything you see on the film or in subsequent films, because it's such a personal loss that the main character has lost. Does that make sense? Yeah. What about you, Ted? Where would you go with that?
Yeah, I was quite fascinated, really, having picked something really interesting, almost by mistake or by, you know, just stumbled into it. Because at first I thought it kind of challenged my perception of what horror was and what the line between Hitchcockian thriller, for example, and horror. But yes, I totally get what you're saying about it being horror. And with that mask on, you're quite right, because all of her acting, the girl that in the lead, was done with her eyes. And you could, she was doing really, really well with that, because she was dancing her eyes around, and you could read things in her eyes. It was all done really, really cleverly. And she was creeping around the house, I thought, like something out of Rebecca. I kept thinking of Hitchcock. I think part of it was to do with shadows and lighting and creating this creepy atmosphere. And the music supported it really well, I thought. It just seemed to get it right at the right times. And when sometimes there was no music at all, and it was these kind of grisly scenes which were done silently. Like, for example, at the beginning when the assistant woman is dumping her body in the river, there's no accompaniment to that at all. It's just like really clinical and silent. But sometimes you've got this kind of clash bang of we briefly see the unmasked face, I think just once, and at that point it suddenly turned into Hitchcock. I thought you got this zoomed in on the face, came into focus, sharp music, the woman that is looking at the face screaming, and it was just all really, really Hitchcock, I thought, and it worked really, really well. It was chilling throughout, completely bonkers from the mad scientist, of course. But it was all, I think it was all about atmosphere, and the black and white also added to the kind of cold clinical feel of it. So I have seen The Skin I Live In, which was mentioned earlier by one of our listeners. And I remember that with a similarly nuts Antonio Banderas character. We've also got the whole Phantom of the Opera thing, which has been done 101 times. The one that you'll know more about probably than me is Face Off, which some places, some people were equating it with. What's the logic there?
They because he takes the girl's face off in the film, because that happens in to Nick Cage and John Travolta. They take their faces off and swap them over.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right, yeah. It's a long time since I saw that. There was things like, for example, the hockey mask in Hannibal and stuff like that. We spoke about Texas Chainsaw Massacre earlier. There seems to be lots of films where masks over the human face is a big feature and is used, but I can't remember particularly a film in which it's done as well as this with the outcomes that it had in terms of the atmosphere and the whole unnerving kind of black and white, as I say. I really, really liked it. I thought it was a great film, really, really well done. I wasn't bothered about the subtitles, and that was fine. And it was seeping with atmosphere, and it was a really good thriller, I think, thriller/horror. But really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah. And what I should have mentioned, the music as well, it was the fact that it's still very, very tense without the score. That just goes to show how well executed this was, because so many films obviously use music as another tool to increase tension, but this one didn't need that tool, and it was still incredibly tense.
It's a
masterpiece. It really is. It's one of the best French horror films of the age.
Highly recommended. So if you haven't seen it, track it down, good listeners, and we'll move on. What's our second venture into the horror-themed treats for the year going to be next show?
Well, I was, browsing through YouTube, and I came across an interview with Quentin Tarantino, and he spoke of a little Australian movie called Dark Age from 1987, which is a crocodile horror film. And I've never seen it. However, I did review a film called Time Guardian over on my... Wasn't it Time Guardian? Yeah, Time Guardian over on my blog. And it kind of fits in with that film because it's got some of the same cast, some of the same crew. Nicky Cockle plays one of the main characters in it. And it's a film that's always, I think I had it on VHS, but I never got around to watching it. I bought it because it looks like Indiana Jones on the front cover with a, you know, an Australian hunter with a fedora and a rifle and things like that, and a cute chick. So I'd love to see that. I'd love to sit down and watch that. And if Tarantino likes it, then I've got a funny feeling that you're going to kind of enjoy it. And it looks like Jaws, but with crocodiles.
Great, yeah. It's funny because if you watch the trailer, the top trailer of it on YouTube, which I did today, the scene that they show in the trailer is just a virtual remake of the one where Brody is on the beach and he spots the shark in the water and he runs across the beach to get everyone out, and it's just like a remake of that. So I think it'll be really interesting to see what this is about, and good pick.
That's Jaws 2 you're talking about there, not Jaws 1.
No. I have to I disagree. It's the one where the woman who loses the boy in the water, and the zoom in on his face on that chair. Yeah. Anyway.
That's right, yeah. I'm thinking where he's up shooting at the shadow under the water. I stand corrected. I'll have to go and watch all the Jaws films again. Okay. I'll take my punishment.
Right, let's go to main feature, and I nominate you to pick your top one first, because I saw you put it in there and watched it for a second time last night to support what you're saying.
Oh, God. Well, it works in tandem with what I said earlier about Sleepless in Seattle. I had to appease a particular woman that I happen to live with in order to watch the second film I will talk about in this section. My wife is a very, very big fan of King Kong movies. She loves them all. But she hadn't actually seen the 1976 version in a long, long time. So we went and revisited that. And it has been a while since I last saw it. And I remember it being an awful lot better, to be honest. But it's still, I still find it quite an interesting film in that the opening, we'll divide it into thirds because there's three different films going on here. There's the opening where they go to the island, then there's On the Island, and then there's Back in Manhattan. That's the setup of King Kong, those three big acts.
Yeah.
The opening act where they're going to the island, I think, is incredibly strong. It's such an interesting interwoven collection of characters. All of them have their benefits, their pros and cons, and things like that. It pulls you in entirely. The middle section is the bit where I feel it is the least enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Where we have Jessica Lange meeting up with Kong and hanging out, and I don't think that is, it's actually that whole sequence is better done by Peter Jackson. It's much more exciting and adventurous and things like that. I just don't find that section, I find it a bit of a trudge to get through it. And then the final act is back to the good old-fashioned fun with King Kong in New York doing the World Trade Center instead of the Empire State Building, which he does in the other two. So it starts and ends really well, and there's a bit of a lull in the middle when it's less entertaining and a bit hokier. Jeff Bridges, I have problems with in the lead role. I just don't think that he is right. He's a better actor than what they needed here. And I think that it's kind of works with Adrian Brody as well in the third version of this film. He was a wee bit more than they needed for that role. The male protagonist in King Kong isn't important. He is just a functionary character who gets things done. The Charles Grodin character is vastly more entertaining, and it almost sort of a bit of a comic relief in a way, that sort of third wheel, the sub character who's the comic relief. Mm-hmm. Jessica Lange is absolutely superb, and in a really light, kind of naive kind of way, where you kind of fall in love with her, but then you pull yourself back, and then fall in love with her again, and pull yourself back. But the main lead is Kong himself, and King Kong gets an awful lot of criticism because it is effectively a man in suit movie, whereas they went with CGI for the third film. Going back and seeing a man in suit looks and feels a bit tacky to start with, but then you realize that the eyes feel really human whenever you see them. They aren't always human eyes, I don't think, but they manage to put across emotion from time to time, in the same way we were talking about with the eyes without a face. And there's a lot working through Kong's eyes, and I think at times they get it wrong, and he looks like a big perv sticking his eyes through the window, and you know, his smile as he's playing with Jessica Lange, you know, you're like, oh dear. It's a wee bit comical how he looks. He looks a bit like, I don't know, Richie from Bottom, or something like that. But toward the climax, as everything's getting dramatic, the eyes just work, and it seems to settle out, and it feels like they've got it right for that moment where Kong is inside the oil tanker looking up at Jessica Lange's character. You really feel for him because there's a lot of work going on there. And it really is. It's a film that falls flat and is crap in areas, but it's really good in other areas. And it just, it kind of effectively works between the two in the same way that the first one is an absolute classic that works almost flawlessly. And then Peter Jackson's one is a really good update that introduces King Kong to a new audience. But this one is just that, this badly made piece of during its time period that just doesn't work all the time. But whenever it does work, it knocks it out of the park. And I don't know that I'll ever watch it again because I'm quite happy with where I am with the film. And I don't want to ruin it that way. because if I watch it again, I might be in a different mood and think, no, this is worser and worser. But I'm interested to hear what you thought of it as well, because I'm still very divided as to whether or not this is a good film or not.
I think it's a good film. I think that I also agree with a lot of what you're saying there, in terms of the three parts. The bit that I thought was weak, this exactly the same as you. It's really spooky, because the middle bit I got a bit fed up with, because for one thing, all the tribesmen and all the people on the island, including the actors playing the invading kind of gunned white men, they just all looked like actors acting. They didn't look the tribesmen just didn't look one bit like proper tribesmen. They looked like actors who'd been made up, and it's hard to
dancers.
Yeah, it's hard to describe, I suppose, exactly what I mean. But if you watch it, you'll see. And the stage as well, the set, all of that middle section just looks like a studio. It's really badly, and maybe that's a result of the time it was in, 1976. You know, you could argue that 1976 is around the middle 70s, the same time as Jaws. But I think that they did a even better job with some of the shots of King Kong than they did with Jaws, for example, which was very, at times, very kind of laughable in terms of, the mechanical shark involved. King Kong, I thought, was on the whole pretty well done. I agree with you. Looking down into the ship there, that was good, and climbing around New York. But again, the weak part was when she was in this great big plastic hand of his, which was just not done very well. It was not, that bit was not CGI. It was presumably a model that someone had made that had got moving fingers to go round Jessica Lange, and it just looked like a big piece of plastic. It was just done really badly. So for possibly slightly different reasons, I agree with you. The middle bit was the weakest bit, and what came around it was actually quite good. And Jeff Bridges, he was all right. I'm not a huge fan of him, really, unlike you, but it was all right. And it was fine apart from that. And I enjoyed watching it. I hadn't seen it for a long, long time, and I thought it was good. So now I need to go and watch this one that you're talking about, which I don't think I have seen, which is the newer CGI one, which is called King Kong.
Peter Jackson. Yeah, Peter Jackson. Oh, no, it's a good film. It is. I like it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is nothing to do with the Kong versus what's it? That's something else, is it?
No, but I think there are people who like to try and link it together. It's entirely an epic, and you get Jack Black in the Charles Grodin role, and Adrian Brody in the Jeff Bridges role, and Naomi Watts. Naomi Watts, she's phenomenal. Yes.
Oh, okay.
As Jessica Lange.
Okay.
I'd say it's more of a remake of the 76 version, more so than the classic one.
Yeah, I have seen the loops out of it. I have seen the classic one. Again, not for a long time. Anyway, I'll put that on my viewing list for watching. Right, my film that I'm going to bring to the main feature is Bambi the Reckoning, which is a completely bonkers I didn't realise this, but apparently there's this thing called the TCU, the Twisted Childhood Universe. And this was this is the organisation that's put together all this Winnie the Pooh stuff and Blood and Honey and all that stuff that we were talking about before. And what was the other one that we were talking about? Humpty Dumpty, wasn't it?
Popeye and Mickey Mouse.
All right, okay. So I've still got a few to go on those, but Bambi the Reckoning. Was it there was that Humpty Dumpty one we watched, wasn't there? Or I
was
watched.
There?
Yeah. There's something in there. I'll find it later and tell you. But that was something of the same kind of genre. Anyway, Bambi the Reckoning, right?
Yeah.
What's it called? Have you found it?
Curse of Humpty Dumpty.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. I remember talking about that on the show.
I'd omitted it from my mind. And The Curse of Humpty Dumpty 2, The Madness of Humpty Dumpty, Cinderella's. Yeah. Oh, there's three films. It's a trilogy.
Yeah, very cool. Anyway, right, back to Bambi. So this is a story about Bambi. And Bambi is left on his own. We know that from the previous story. And also at the beginning of this film, they do a kind of animated catch-up on where Bambi came from. Nasty people shot his mum, as we all know. Anyway, later on in life, Bambi hooks up with this this lady, Bambi, called Feline. And Feline, similarly, is shot by these people who are doing nasty things in terms of pharmaceuticals. And what they're doing is they are dumping toxic waste in Bambi's forest. So what happens is that the water in the river gets infected with this toxic waste, and Bambi drinks it. And so Bambi turns into this kind of hugely antlered, shark teeth, massive kind of beast of a Bambi. The teeth are really funny to look at. You know, they're just like a looking into the mouth of Jaws. And so Bambi's going kind of berserk in terms of revenge, particularly as these people, these nasty people, have also kidnapped his newborn and put it in a cage. So Bambi is trying to get revenge on everyone, basically. And so from there on, really, there's a story going on about a son and a woman who are going to stay in the woods, and her husband, and it turns out the husband's one of the nasty people. And we get lots of scenes then about people being killed by nasty Bambi, and the toxic waste has found its way through to a local rabbit warren. And so we get these killer rabbits involved as well now, and it's just all really, really good fun, completely bizarre. The special effects are not badly done, really. It's just all bonkers fun, all tongue-in-cheek, like the Winnie the Pooh stuff, really. You've just got to approach it in that kind of way. There is gore, and there's you know, people being ripped apart by ripped in two by Bambi and the rabbits, and the special effects are, well, they could have been, I've actually, in my review, I put laughable, but maybe that's a bit harsh. You know, it's a low budget thing. The script is diabolical. The acting, I'm sure on purpose, like the other films, is just really, really bad. And the only one positive thing, bizarrely, I found about it, in it, was that some of the interior photography was done quite well. Some of the lighting, when they were inside buildings, the lighting and photography was done really, really nicely. I've no idea where that came from. But anyway, this is a story about mad Bambi with shark teeth going bonkers and ripping people apart. And you can guess who the survivors are of this, and who the people don't survive in this story, because it's just very obvious. In the post-credits scene, which is quite interesting, we see a caption come up that says, "Bambi will return." And apparently there's a new crossover film coming called Pooniverse Monsters Assemble. So watch out for that one. This Bambi the Reckoning is currently on Amazon Prime, if you fancy a laugh. And it is a laugh. It's just more of the same from this twisted childhood universe. It's a complete scream, and I totally recommend it.
Right, okay. It's interesting to think that the young ones foreshadowed this.
Oh, yeah, Bambi.
Is it true? Did you do a Disney nasty?
Yeah, yeah.
Unbelievable. You know, this, and you're doing well with this. You've watched through most of these now.
Yeah, yeah. I think I have.
You have to work out which ones you've missed, or if there are any that you've missed, and fill in those gaps.
Yeah, okay. That's another project.
Oh, wow. I'm trying to work out how many films are in this universe now. I'm looking for production. They're British, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're all shot in forests in the Midlands and that sort of thing. It usually says at the end where it's all been done on these films. What were the other ones? Childhood horror movie.
I've got them here. There's Bambi the Reckoning, Peter Pan's Neverland Nightmare.
No.
Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey.
Yeah.
Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 2.
Yeah.
It's not out yet. Pinocchio Unstrung is coming soon. Pooniverse Monsters Assemble is
coming
soon.
That's the one I'm talking about, yeah.
There's a few here that aren't. There's Spiders on a Plane, Freddy's Friday, and Snake Hotel. Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 3. You'll be pleased to hear this.
Is that coming?
Right. Yes.
What about
Awakening, Sleeping Beauty?
Oh, no, I didn't know about Sleeping Beauty. Is Humpty Dumpty not in there? Is that some other crap?
Yeah, Curse the Humpty Dumpty.
Okay.
Humpty Dumpty 2. Yeah, okay. There's Amityville Scarecrow.
But I've obviously got quite a lot to watch. The trouble is that they tend to be kind of very similar. In fact, in two or three of the films, even the characters are the same, you know, the same actors. The, you know, the group of students, no doubt, which are having a laugh with all this.
I don't know their students. I think they're full-on filmmakers. Given the list of stuff here, you know, this company has been making a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. For quite some time, you know, mm-hmm. the last 10 years, they've been cranking out direct-to-video, direct-to-Amazon Prime horror films. Return of Krampus came out, and Evil Genie, Crocodile Swarm, Dragon Fury, The Mutation.
Wow.
It Came from Below. Actually, I've seen It Came from Below. That's right. Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't realize that was British. Okay. Dinosaur Hotel.
The Twisted Childhood Universe. In Wikipedia, they're listing them all in there as well.
Ah, okay.
Where can you see the...
Right, well,
oh,
you'll have to get through these.
There's an
I expect them all reviewed next week.
There's an untitled Mary Poppins film. That would be a real scream, wouldn't it? Bambi,
I wonder if Dick Van Dyke's been asked to...
Yeah.
He could finish off his filmography with a nasty.
Yeah.
Ooh, that would be good.
Anyway, there you go. I recommend it to anyone that's fancying a bit of complete bonkers horror, kind of low-budget horror.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely worthwhile.
Okay, what have you got to round us up with?
Well, I've got one last film that I wanted to quickly mention. Not so much to review it, but I wanted to just pay it homage because I absolutely adore it, and I treated my son to watching it over Christmas, even though it's rated 18. It's not as violent. There's a bit of blood spatter and some bad words and things like that, but that can be contended with as you're watching it. It is James Cameron's The Terminator, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton, Michael Biehn, and Lance Hendrickson and Paul Winfield. It's a classic sci-fi action movie that I actually noticed so much more about whenever you've gotten past the plot and the action sequences and you're just watching it for enjoyment, you start to realize all the little things, the little details that they've packed in. And I'd never really looked for that kind of extra level of storytelling. You know, there's little things, like one of the most notable things that I kept noticing more and more once I first clocked, it was like, oh, is Michael Penn's character of Kyle Reese is obviously a soldier from the future where the Earth's pretty much rubble. There's a couple of cars you see in the future that are raking about and smashed up and things like that. And as a result, whenever he travels back in time and he takes a car in 1984, he doesn't turn the lights on. And I'm sort of sitting thinking, in every car chase that he's involved in, every time he's driving a car, he doesn't have the headlights on. And the majority of the film is set at night, driving around the city. I'm like, is he not turning the headlights on, A, because in the future he doesn't have headlights, all the bulbs are broken? Or is it because they don't turn them on so that they don't attract attention from the cyborgs that are destroying the land. And that, you know, it's all those little things that make you just realize just how well they thought this out and how beautifully the script was written. And knowing where the series goes, with the plot details that they managed to take to create the second film and the third film, I feel that so many other franchises need to look at how those three films work together. Now, I'm not saying that Terminator 3 is a superb movie or anything, but I think it's actually a pretty damn good conclusion to the trilogy, the original trilogy. Things that happen afterward were a big stretch, but where they told those three films, I think they work quite well, and the third one does falter a good bit, but they take tangible and acceptable story elements to extend the film rather than having to hook everything in, you know, where, you know, well, this character and that character, and we need to bring Arnie back for this, and we need to do that in order to be able to get this to work, so we have to explain that by this, and it's all hooky ideas. But the first film is just such an incredible feat. I would say that I prefer the first one over the second one. I know a lot of people will go, no, the Terminator 2 is absolutely superb. It is, don't get me wrong. But then, you know, I think it's because of that. Maybe I just watched the second one to death when I was younger, and I didn't see the first Terminator as much because it wasn't as cool. And it's the same with Die Hard. You know, Die Hard 2, I started to prefer because I watched Die Hard too many times. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom I started to prefer because Raiders of the Lost Ark and Last Crusader were the ones that I always watched. So the one that you know the least then becomes your favourite because it's got new things to offer. And this really offered an awful lot more for me to enjoy. And looking at Linda Hamilton's performance there and Michael Penn's performance, and they're superb. They really are high quality actors, and I'm so surprised that they didn't suddenly become, you know, big mainstream stars following this, because what they do is superb on screen. Michael Benn obviously went on to star in a few movies and never quite recaptured the popularity here, as was the case with Linda Hamilton too. But then, I hate to say this, but that generally happens with female actresses that are actors. They don't get the big chances that the likes of Arnold Schwarzenegger would get, or the big paychecks and things to be able to become. And thankfully, that's changed now, where it's all different now, where, you know, an actress can suddenly become the biggest thing in Hollywood. But then looking through it, you've got all the little characters as well. You've got Bill Paxton turning up as a punk rocker, and Brian Thompson, who's the villain from Cobra, isn't he? As another punk as well, and then Dick Miller in a little role as well. Lance Hendrickson as the police officer, and it's an interesting bit of trivia is that Lance Hendrickson was originally considered to be the Terminator before they managed to get Arnie, and Lance was going to play it. And I really love the film, and my son quite enjoyed it. But I think it's one of those films that's going to grow on him over time as he watches the rest of the series. He'll realise just how good it was. And I'm wondering if maybe the youth of today are so spoiled by the big grandeur that they have in all their computer games and video games and things like that, and the likes of every Jurassic Park movie trying to outdo the last one, whenever they go back and watch something small and humble like The Terminator or Raiders of the Lost Ark, it's not quite as mesmerizing as it was for me when I was young. And that said, whenever I look back to something like The Great Escape, which, you know, it excited a whole generation of how wonderful that film was when it came along, I don't rate that as highly as the likes of Raiders of the Lost Ark or Star Wars, because they were the ones that blew my socks off. So going back and seeing that is a bit, it's not as much fun. So, you know, I don't know where this little pace has gone on, this monologue that I'm doing about the Terminator. But I think that, yeah, people should really revisit the Terminator, and I'm sure a lot of people do, and it's one of those ones they watch every couple of years. It's been a while since I watched it, and I've been saving it, much like I'm saving Robocop as well, until a couple of years from now, whenever Austin's a wee bit older, and we'll watch it then, and Alien, and Aliens. And I look forward to revisiting them as well, and just having a thought about them, because they're great for good reason, and they're very much worth revisiting even today, because I don't think that level of detail is in the new movies that we see today, especially in the likes of Bambi, The Reckoning. Have you seen the Terminator series, all of them?
Yeah, I have. And I've seen them when they first came out and never watched them again. And so it's 20-plus years since I even saw the third one. And I'm just looking at the third one, rolling the trailer on IMDb now, and I can't remember anything about it, frankly. So I would probably need to start again. The thing that struck me about the second one, I remember, and that's what I remember the most, like you were saying, really, about people's favourites, was the CGI and the melting cop thingy, and I can remember when I first saw that, I was just completely bowled over and totally fascinated, saying, "How on earth do they do that? That is just so incredible." And so that just hooked me into that one film, I think, because I just kept looking at that going on. The first one is embarrassingly full of 1980s hair, I'm afraid. Female hair do's in the 80s were just so embarrassingly crap. And it kind of, it just makes the thing look stupid now, frankly. But I would, I would have to go back and start again, I think, Gareth. I'd need to watch the first one, get myself back into the whole thing and go through all three of them again, if I was going to.
Yeah. No, it's a good series to start. Does get a bit hokey as it goes on, but I've only seen four, five, and six, and seven. I can't remember how many there are, but I've seen 1, 2, and 3 a few times, and the last part of the series only once each, because they're not easily rewatchable, I don't think. But I will work my way through them slowly over the course of the year.
Right, okay then, you do that, and while we are heading towards 2 hours on this podcast, we shall leap as quickly as we can into coming soon. What have you brought for us?
Okay, well, we're going to start off with the crap, and that is Supergirl, which, Ted, I'm going to let you take the lead in this, because I have absolutely no faith that this is going to be any good whatsoever.
No, and I, to be honest with you, I thought that this was going to be good, but as soon as the trailer started, the lead actress, whoever she is doing this forced creaky voice thing, which is so annoying. Apparently it's called vocal fry. I didn't know that. I looked it up on Gemini. And it's purposely making your voice lower and croaking it to be giving this air of can't be bothered and super cool. And to me, that just switched me off completely. In this trailer, half of it is her doing that, and I just cannot be watching that. I cannot be bothered with it. And apart from that, it just looked a little superhero claptrap to me anyway, but I'm sure people that like superhero stuff will be all over it. Did you agree with that?
I did, yes. I was fairly entertained by some of the special effects, but it's not something that I'm going to watch, and I will vocal fry it entirely. Like, whatever.
So annoying.
Yeah. Next up, this is for you, Ted, and it's called By Design. The plot is essentially just a twist on body swap genre, and it opens with a line that kind of explains it quite well, I would say. Have you heard about this movie where Juliette Lewis plays a chair? yes, of course, but remind me about the chair part. This is a very arty-farty movie that I'm sure that you will dig because it's got Juliette Lewis in it.
I won't.
All right. Where I think I think the storyline is essentially that people might put more thought and effort into choosing a chair than they do their partners or something like that, or they see their partners in the same way as they would choose a chair or some shit like that. Ted, tell me that you were interested in this.
I completely am not. I saw this before you put it in the show notes. I had seen the trailer for this before, and when I saw it then I thought, what on earth is... I mean, I'm okay with art house, I really am, as you well know, but this just absolutely looks like a load of ludicrous, pretentious bollocks. Absolute codswallop. I can't believe that Juliette Lewis has got involved with it. It just looks stupid and nonsense. I can't believe they've done this. Very, very stupid and silly. Go away.
Well, my main hope is that this is actually like a Naked Gun style spoof of art house movies. That's the potential.
Oh, right. Okay. They're taking the piss.
This is just my theory. If it's not that, then good God.
Exactly.
All right. Moving on. The next one is based on a video game. This is called Iron Lung. In a post-apocalyptic future after the Quiet Rapture event, I was being gravelly trailer guy actually there, not vocal fry. A convict explores a blood ocean on a desolate moon using a submarine called the Iron Lung to search for missing stars and planets. This looks like a very claustrophobic little film about a small spacecrafty thing navigating through a ocean of blood with leaks and clanks and concerns. The video game was not a huge hit. It was very much a cult hit. I've never played it myself, but I thought the film actually looked kind of weird and interesting enough that I might give it a go. Ted?
Weird and uninteresting, I would say. And I've never heard of the game, and this looked like a kind of episode of Red Dwarf or something, which has gone completely wrong. This is just not for me. I guess if you played the game and you knew the game, or if you were really into this kind of genre of film, you might want to give it a go. It just looks stupid to me. Sorry.
Well, I do actually have kind of high hopes for it because it's coming to theatres at the end of January, which makes me think that there is enough here that they've warranted theatrical distribution. So it might be good enough that they're expecting it to have a return dumping it and streaming.
Okay, in that case, they ought to make the trailer much better and more interesting to hook in people that don't know the game and are not interested in it.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Next is Ponies. This is a new TV series that is arriving on Peacock on January the 15th, which is next week. This is about two secretaries at the American Embassy in 1970s Moscow who become CIA operatives as their husbands are killed, uncovering a Cold War conspiracy behind the tragedy. I don't know how many, I think it's 8 episodes long, possibly. But it looks like a fairly decent little Cold War thriller, the likes of which we don't really get anymore. And it seems to be quite funny. It seems to have a bit of action, a wee bit of thrills, a bit of drama here and there. So I think this might be all-encompassing, and I'm quite excited about it. Would Ted be?
If they would just take the unfunny American comedy out of it, I think it's a real shame, because if you take away the attempts at trying to make it funny and the kind of buddy cop thing thrown in, which essentially they're making these two wives, these two lead characters, a pair of buddy cops in the process and trying to make them funny. And it's just like, why don't you just make a... Just take away the comedy, because the bones of this story actually look really interesting, and they've just screwed it up, in my humble opinion.
Well, it could be one of those trailers that's kind of trying to cater for all markets, where it might have turned you off, but other people will very much enjoy. Is that Howard? Ooh, Howard is in here.
Howard?
From Better Call Saul. Howard Hamlin.
Oh, is he? In Ponies?
Yeah.
Ah, uh-huh. Wow.
Wow. He's in Pluribus as well.
Hmm. Person of no interest was the that's what came out in the trailer. They worked that out, didn't they? Howard Hamlin.
That's right.
So he's in this.
Next up.
Oh yeah, so he is.
Yes.
He's CIA director. Oh, George Bush. Okay. Let's carry on.
Okay, the next one is a little one that I threw in at the last minute, Ted. And it's an Irish horror film starring Adam Scott. Hey. It's directed by Damien McCarthy, who did Oddity, which I think most of us watched and most of us enjoyed. Mm-hmm. It's called Hook'em, and it looks class. This is about a horror writer who visits an Irish inn to scatter his parents' ashes, unaware that the property is said to be haunted by a witch.
I haven't actually seen Oddity yet. I keep trying to get to it, and I keep being sidetracked. But now you've put this in here, I will. The trailer is really teasy trailer, isn't it? But I think that from what we can see from it, it does look really. You know, I like some of the imagery in the trailer. Some of the shots that they're placing people's heads in the corner of frames, and it looks like it's been really well thought out. So I will be looking forward to this. It's just that I was hoping the trailer might give us a bit more.
Oh, no. There's just enough there. It seems a lot happens in this. There's all kinds of scary things, and you get quick flashes of all that. But it'll arrive on the 1st of May, and I can't wait.
Cool.
Welcome. It's good to see Adam Scott doing something quite serious.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
All right. There's another one.
Ooh. I put that in because I saw it pop up today, and I know you haven't had a chance to look at it, but I did also think that maybe we'd already done it, because there seems to be some confusion. It's a film called Rabbit Trap 2025, and it looks like it's already been at the cinema, but it's coming to streaming in January. And I'm not sure if we've covered this one before or not, have I? A married couple are two musicians who move from London to a cottage in Wales to complete their new album. By accident, they record a mystical sound never heard of before, and gradually disconnect from reality. And actually, Dev Patel's in it, and it kind of rings a bell, but not a huge bell. I don't know if you can remember, but it's staged as a folk horror in the middle of Wales somewhere. Do you remember us doing this?
I think I do, yeah. I recognise the poster when you're saying about the album and the record of sound, unless that has happened in something else.
Parallel universe.
Yeah, it's arriving January 30th, so we can watch it and go, oh, seen this before, or not.
You'd have had to see it at the cinema, probably, up to now. I think it said it came to the cinema in September, but anyway, I'll stick it in the recording, the show notes anyway, in case I'm wrong and we haven't done it. And so there it is. It's called Rabbit Trap, and it looks quite quirky and dark and mysterious, and I think that might be quite cool. Right, before we go, we have got a couple of people in the final curtain, one of whom was incredibly good-looking.
Well, yes, very sadly, on December the 28th, at the age of 91, we lost Brigitte Bardot, who was a French actress and singer and model, who became one of the biggest and most famous sex symbols in the 50s and 60s. And she was a massive public figure in popular culture. She didn't just star in movies. She shifted sort of global standards in beauty and fashion and things like that, and even female liberation. Some of her classic films include the likes of I'm just having a quick look down her filmography here to see what we've got. We've got Contempt from 1963 and The Warrior's Rest, and Woman Was Created in 1956, and The Truth from 1960. I know her from a Sean Connery Western called Shalako, but I'm struggling to work out anything else that I've seen her in, because I'm not, things aren't jumping out at me. And I think that I'm a wee bit weak whenever it comes to Brigitte Bardot movies. Oh, Doctor at Sea, I've seen that one.
I think in my mind, she's just much more famous for all the things that you just said than having seen, you know, someone that you can say a list of films that you've seen them in, because I'm doing the same as you. I'm looking through the list of films, and frankly, I can't think of any that I could pinpoint and say, oh, yeah, of course, she was in that. I mean, most of it was done before 1973. So, you know, to be fair, it was quite, you know, she was born in 1934. So it was quite a long time ago. But her name has just always been synonymous with, you know, crackingly good-looking person and always being around, you know, on telly and just a sex symbol. So, yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. And because mainly she made a lot of French films and things like that maybe didn't get full release here in Northern Ireland, outside of people going and enthusiastically looking for them. Mm-hmm. But she sort of, I think she finished acting around about 1970 or so, 1973 it was, and became a public figure more so than just being an actress anymore. Yeah,
she was very sad 34. To hear. She would have been 29 then, wouldn't she? 1934, 64, no, 39. So yeah, she acted up to 39 by the looks of it.
Very
sad.
Very much so. We also lost Ishall Whitlock Jr., who passed away on the 30th of November, or 30th of December, sorry, 2025, at the age of 71 after a short illness. He was best known for playing the state senator of Clay Davis on The Wire. And he worked with Spike Lee a number of times, including The 25th Hour and Black Klansman and The Five Bloods, I think I saw earlier. He's a very well-known actor, and obviously The Wire is probably what he'll be best remembered for, because it's such a huge, huge hit. I think he was in Veep as well, which is a very popular American comedy drama, political comedy drama. Do you know Ishall?
Yeah, I know from The Wire, but I, to be honest, I didn't really like The Wire. I watched the first series of it, and then I kind of gave up on it, really. So it wasn't really my thing. He was in one Woody Allen film, though, and I'm trying to picture his part in that. He plays a cop in Everyone Says I Love You, and I can't quite get to picturing his role in that, but that might also be where I would know his face from. But yeah, I think it's just one of these actors where there's a picture here which is very clear to me, that I know The Good Cop. So he was in this long-running series called The Good Cop, and I'm sure that I probably have seen an episode of that or two, because I really recognize the picture that I see him in there. So yeah, very sad.
Yeah, he was in Cocaine Bear as well, but honestly I can't remember exactly where. Provided a voice for Lightyear, that animated movie of Buzz Lightyear from Toy Story.
right Remember that The Hunted, FBI. Oh, that's only one episode. The Good Cop is 10 episodes. The Mist he was in, 2017. I don't think I saw that.
That was the TV series.
Yeah, that's right. And he was in six in Law and Order. I didn't think I see Lucky Seven. Maybe this is stuff that's just passed me by and I haven't seen it. Anyway, yeah, I do definitely recognise him. And if I had paid more attention to The Wire, I'd have known him better, I think. Anyway, right.
Working on that.
Thank you. Yes, we're over 2 hours, so let's call it to a close. GarethMiles.com is where you'll find Gareth's stuff. TedSalmon.com is where you'll find me, and PodHub UK is where you'll find everything too. Projectorroom.co.uk is our website. You'll find links to all the stuff we've been talking about there. Ted Salmon, if you get lost, TedSalmon.com has got links to all our MeWe groups, all of our other audio podcasts. So, head there and you'll find it. Otherwise, we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. And we hope that in the meantime, you'll tell us what you've been watching so we can scoop it up from the MeWe group, or email us or do what you like with it. And we hope you'll join us again in a fortnight's time in the projector room.